Part of me wants to ask how many of you have a favorite hymn, but you are all Anglicans, so I know you do. I do want to take just a minute today to talk about the hymn we opened with, 374. If you want to turn in your hymnals and read along, that might be helpful, or it might not, but my preaching professor in seminary would say that as Anglicans, we sing some of our theology. And it's always interesting to me the phrases and meanings that are sometimes layered into our hymnody. She was very correct, which is no surprise. She's a very wise person. I started this morning with one plan. That was to talk a bit about the fourth verse, especially at the top of the second page, where it goes, "Thou within the veil hast entered, robed in flesh our great high priest." So we'll talk about that for just a second. In Jesus' time, churches didn't exist, first of all, but even synagogues and temples had, there was an odd feature, at least I think to our minds, to Western Christian minds from a few centuries later. It was in the most sacred part of it, there was a veil so that ordinary folks would not contaminate it with our sinfulness. And then within that, only the great high priest could go. He, and it was always a he back then, could only go once a year. And the conviction was that if within the veil, in that sacred space, he encountered the divine, he would probably die, because that is what usually happened to people if they saw God face to face. God was so great, they died. So this was a problem, because he could only go in there alone, and they didn't want to leave a dead body in there. So two things would be true. One, there were bells on the edge of his robes, so they could hear him move. And two, they would tie a rope to one of his ankles, so if he stopped moving or didn't come back, they could pull him out and bury him properly. It's an odd practice, I think, to us, like I said. But that is what these lines in this song are referencing. That Jesus is our great high priest, which I think is a concept that sounds vaguely familiar to a lot of us. And that's where it starts to get a little, it disrupts expectations from the high priest who would go into the holiest of holy spaces alone, wearing the special clothes, and sort of protected to make sure that nothing bad could happen. Here we have a high priest who goes behind the veil into this holiest of places, robed in flesh, made like us. And there's some disruption of what we think of holy as being not like us. The hymn lyrics play on the fact that Jesus was made like us. I enjoy that. But this morning, as we were singing it, as I was planning to talk about that, something else struck me. And it's worth pointing out here that I have really clear memories of singing this hymn from about age 15. And this is a brand new thought I had this morning. And the first and the last verses, which sort of are the same, they echo each other in some really strong ways. Again, on the top of the second page, you get this phrase, "The songs of peaceful Zion thunder like a mighty flood." And it was this morning as we were singing this that I remembered that flood has a particular resonance when we're talking about biblical texts, because we all know the story of the flood, right? Noah, the ark, God is going to flood the earth and wipe out everything that God doesn't like on the face of the earth. It's a very threatening image. really, this it's not a happy story. It's not a happy story. And here, again, this hymn writer likes to sort of play with these images and subvert them a little. Because instead of the threat of sort of worldwide death that it is part of the flood story that we know, you get a flood coming out of Zion with songs of peace. The promise of God has become one of joy. You sing when you rejoice in the Bible, and one of peace. I like, we often sing the hymns and we are caught up in not singing too fast or too slow or too horribly or too loudly if we don't sing well, me. Sometime, I don't know, if you don't like the sermon, if the readings aren't working for you, sit and flip through the hymnal. There's a lot of really beautiful lyrics, some really gorgeous poetry in the hymns. And sometimes, even when it is a hymn you know very well and have sung for years and years, you can come to appreciate something new about it. How many of you have purchased land? Many of you. A lot of hands went up. You don't have to still own it, just if you've gone through the process of buying property. Yeah. Is that an easy process? There's just laughter out here. I didn't think so. I was thinking about this morning because that's what Jeremiah does. We have this whole story, but really what he does is he buys some land from a cousin. And his process is also not easy. It's not quite our process where it's about money and if it's being sold, and we have our own legal system and structure to take care of that, which also existed in Jeremiah's time. But he does something different than that sort of straightforward, I'm selling the land, you're buying the land. Am I asking a fair price? Do you have the money to pay for the land? He buys it under the right of redemption, which is not a legal concept we've held onto in North America. It never really makes it, I think, far out of Israel itself. And to understand that, we have to sort of go back a ways to the beginning of Israel as Jeremiah began to understand it. The Israelites have been wandering in the desert for 40 years. Moses has died, and they are about to cross into the promised land, and the land gets broken up. You might remember long before this, you have Joseph and the 12 tribes of Israel, and the land is sort of roughly divided among them. Well, when the Israelites come back into this land, they become the Israelites again instead of just the Hebrews. They redivide the land up. In these days, there was no option for doing what I have spent most of my adult life doing, renting a place to live and making your living apart from working the land. You need land to survive. And they know this. So they do two things. One is they institute, I call it a year of jubilee, where in theory, you have no evidence this was ever practiced, but in theory, all debts would be forgiven and all land would be returned to their ancestral homes. So if, say, you and your entire household had gone into bankruptcy and had to sell your land to get out of that, in a year of jubilee, that would be forgiven and your land would revert to you. Your slate would be sort of wiped clean and you'd get another chance. We have no proof that actually happened. It was one of those things that they sort of liked the idea of, but nobody was ever actually willing to give things back and forgive debt. Still working on that one. The other thing they did is if your family had land and there was no one to inherit it, who had no male heirs. And it's redundant, they had to be male to be an heir. Before you could sell it to just sort of anyone, you had to give the rest of your family the right to buy it, so that it would stay with the family and continue to take care of your family. The other place we see this sort of action play out is in the book of Ruth, where it's a little different and there's marriage tied up in it. But we also see it right here in Jeremiah, where his cousin can't pass the land on, wants to sell it, and Jeremiah is the closest relative who would otherwise inherit it, so he gets the chance to buy it first. So that's sort of the ancient history that feeds into this morning's story. The rest of it, the text sort of lays out for us. Jeremiah is in prison. His freedoms are curtailed. He can only do so many things, probably because, they don't quite spell this out, but it's probably because for the entire rest of the book of Jeremiah, he's not very happy with Israel, so the king puts him under house arrest. And the other thing we are told is that he is in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is under siege by the Babylonian armies. Now, we know the end of this story, but Jeremiah knew it too, because this is why he had made the king mad. He kept telling him he was going to lose the war. Jerusalem isn't going to stand. Babylon's armies will pour in over her wall, will raise the wall and the city, and will cart most of Israel back to Babylon. The Babylonian exile is almost tomorrow. Now, I have never lived in a country where my home is threatened by war, but from what I can gather, the thing you do at this point in time isn't buy more land in that country. The thing you do at this point in time is look for a place to flee to, is gather what you can carry, and say goodbye to the land you and your family have lived on for generations. That's not what Jeremiah does. That's not what God tells Jeremiah to do. One, he's under house arrest, so it would be hard for him to flee. He's kind of tied to the fate of the king, which means that Jeremiah knows that fleeing would be his best option. His far more likely fate at this point in time in his story is death or exile in Babylon, where again, he has made everyone who will be with him very angry at him for telling them they will lose the war. So that would not be fun at all. And then his cousin shows up, probably desperately hoping to get some cash, some actual money in his hands so he can flee. I can't prove that, but that would be my guess, based on what we know is going on in Jerusalem, in Israel, and in this story. And says, "Do you want to buy my field? Please? It's yours. I have to offer it to you before I can sell it to anyone else." So Jeremiah has two options. One, he can say, "I have no interest in this. You can sell it to whomever." Or two, he can do what he does, which is buy the field. He buys the field because God has told him this is going to happen and that buying the field is important. So we get the whole story of buying the field. He calls someone to write up the purchase. There are two copies made. He weighs the money out, just so we're all very clear that he's not cheating anyone. This is done in the most proper manner it can be done in. And then he does something strange. He turns to Baruch. Baruch would sort of been in the house of the prophets of Jeremiah. He would have followed Jeremiah around. We know this from other parts of the book of Jeremiah. He would have helped write things down. He was sort of an aide. But he wasn't under house arrest with Jeremiah. And he says, keep track of these. This is the promise that land, vineyards, that houses, that these parts of our common life will be bought and sold in this land again. That the life we're about to lose, in other words, because Babylon is literally at the gates of our city, will come back. It's a statement of profound hope. It's a statement of hope that at the moment, you have to imagine, because they say all these witnesses look at this, all these witnesses must have been sitting there going, is he crazy? Babylon is at our gates. We're about to lose everything. He is under house arrest. This does not end well. But sure, if you want to buy the what, fine. It was a hope so distant, it was crazy. Jeremiah's life did not, in fact, end well. He didn't wind up in Babylon, which was probably just fine. He would not have been popular. He would have been hated and reviled by both people in Babylon, Babylonians and the Israelites in exile. He winds up being carted out in service to a different king, the king who imprisoned him, shockingly does not survive Babylon taking Jerusalem. Scholars believe it is most likely that Jeremiah wound up fleeing to Egypt and dying in a less hostile exile than the one he would have faced in Babylon. We don't know what happened to this land, this great promise Jeremiah made on behalf of God for the future of Israel. That the exile, which was about to happen, would someday end. That people would come home, that their land would still be there, that they would still be able to buy and sell and live in the heart of what God had promised them. We don't know. The text doesn't provide us with sort of map coordinates that we could go back and track it down with. But here's what we do know. The Babylonian Empire would fall to Cyrus. And Cyrus, as an act of good faith, would send Israelites home. If they wanted to go, they could go back to their land. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah recount the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem and the resettlement of their homes. Jeremiah didn't live to see it. None of the people in that room with him lived to see it. They died, and their children and their children's children and their children's children's children eventually came home. And land was bought and sold, vineyards were bought and sold, homes were bought and sold. Sometimes when we know the end of the story, I think it's hard to grasp the magnitude of the promise that God made through Jeremiah's acts. That as the country was about to be carted off into exile, as the city, the heart of Israel, was about to be burned down and dismantled, that wasn't the end of the story. It should have been. For a lot of nations, their story ends just that way. That is how the Babylonian story would end. An army came and ravaged their city and dismantled their empire. But that was not the end of the story of Jerusalem. Impossible promises in impossible circumstances. something our God likes to do a lot, isn't it? Look at a set of circumstances, and knowing that our reaction is the world is about to end, saying, but I am not about to abandon my people. It's something that we hear again and again in Scripture. Whether it's Joseph leading his people to Egypt as an act of safety, Moses leading his people out of Egypt into greater promise and hope, whether it's Jeremiah buying land he will probably never set foot on, whether it's disciples trying to figure out what to do when their teacher has been killed, whether it's those stories in our own lives that when it seemed that life was just horrible and we couldn't do anything about it. If you look in the Bible, we have told these stories again and again, and we focus almost exclusively on the promise of hope that God has offered, because we have seen it happen. We know how the story ends, and how the story after that ends, and the story after that ends. And in our own lives, when we look back at the moments where it was horrible and there seemed like there was no hope, we know how those stories end. We know how it worked out. What we count as lost and worth grieving in those stories, and what we count as the promise of hope. The trick isn't looking back at Jeremiah's story and seeing hope. The trick is reading Jeremiah's story as one of the witnesses who watched him buy land that Babylon was about to occupy. That's who we usually are in this story, isn't it? We aren't Jeremiah. We're certainly not God. We might be the cousin who is so desperate they will try anything, but usually we're the people who watch this go on, who wonder what the point is and how any of this can work out well. Maybe there was one person in that room who walked away and decided to hope, who told their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren that although life had changed entirely, God had promised not to abandon God's people. And isn't that really what our choice is? We are going to watch this happen in fear, or to watch these things happen, to live through them, holding on to the great and eternal promise of God that in this we are not alone. That in the great and the horrible, in the scary and the sad, the final word is always had by the God who loves us. Amen.